Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending on where you are. What a treat it is to get to talk again to Alison Mockler, whom you will deduce, looking at him on the screen, is actually Alan Gordon, yes. Author of one of my all-time favorite historical mystery series starring Fest the Fool. So if you can find them, I really recommend reading. And was the first one called 13th Night? I was trying to
Yes, it was.
Right. I keep confusing it with the 13th Tale, the Diane Sitterfield book, you know, because they sound similar. But anyway, Fest was wonderful. And I guess a reasonable question, Alan, would be what draws you to British historical fiction, even though you've skipped centuries moving yourself up to post-World War II London in this series?
Yeah, well, it was a talk with my editor who had run across an actual marriage bureau in pre-war London. And he thought that might be a fun milieu for a mystery series. And he basically invited me to lunch and suggested it. And I said, yeah, but I would like to do it if we're going to do that post-war, because I thought that period was even more interesting. And I didn't want to have my characters sort of, you know, solving mysteries while dodging the Blitz kind of things. Right. That would have been a little bit too much, I thought. So the post-war period I find very interesting because everything's in recovery and the Cold War is starting up and the empire is starting to collapse. And it was just a lot of things going on that I thought were interesting.
Well, there are a lot of things going on. And additionally, a lot of the roles of women that changed during the war are now going to perhaps change back again, or perhaps not. We've seen drama about some of the women who worked at Bletchley, who really did not want to go back to a domestic life. And so it was a transitional time. It was also, rationing was still in effect. Britain really got hammered in the war on many fronts, part of which you'd think we would have learned is they stretched their supply lines way too far. And the disruption of the war, wouldn't you think we would have figured that out before the pandemic made that a problem?
You just froze me, Barbara. I'm sorry.
What? Did I disappear?
You froze for a second there.
Oh, sorry. I was saying, wouldn't you think that we might have figured this out before COVID revealed that we had stretched our own supply lines way too far?
Yeah.
But here we are.
Well, rationing was very much a part of the plot of the first book, The Right Sort of Man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm looking at the shortages, I'm looking at the changes in what women were going through, looking at those women who were actually traumatized by the war, which is a theme that I think has not been really addressed in fiction. We see a lot of, you know, oh, the men are coming back and they're suffering from this and suffering from that. And nobody talks about what the women did, whether they were, you know, actively part of the war effort or left behind and widowed, as one of my characters is in this case. So I have two characters, one who was widowed by the war and the other who had worked in intelligence and ran into some violence that she didn't expect. So they're both dealing with some of their own personal demons while trying to recover and run a business as well in a world that didn't really expect women to run businesses. So that's all been part of the fun of work looking at this period.
Well, I think, you know, you've had a long journey for one of them, the widow, because her in-laws have been difficult and unkind to her. And she is actually a ward of the Lunacy Court, which is something we might not have thought about. And that seems like such an anachronism, even in 1946 or 47, whenever this is set. But clearly it was not.
Yeah, I was actually called that through 1947. There was a brief time where they were calling it, I think, something like the Ministry of Adjustment Disorders. And then somebody said, well, that just spells mad, so that's no better. But they finally changed it in 1947, which is after the period of this book. I'm still writing in 1946, to the Court of Personal Protection. And that's what I think it's still called to this day.
Right, which is sort of a euphemism. But the truth is, you know, if you go all the way back to Wilkie Collins and The Woman in White, women superfluous or difficult or unwanted, or actually people in the way when somebody wanted something they owned, were often at risk of some kind of confinement or supervision by, you know, either in a sanitarium or a madhouse or under the Lunacy Court. And that's kind of what's going on here, because your widow has a young son and property, right?
Mm-hmm. She and yes, she had she had married into a wealthy family, right, and her husband was the sole son of the family. And then when he's killed in the war, their son is actually now the heir to the estate, even though he's only six. Plus she and herself has inherited her husband's property, which includes a 40% share of the family company. So all of that is now in the control of what they would call a committee, what we might call a conservator. And a committee was one person. It was to whom your property was committed, as opposed to what we think of as a committee, as a group of people. So he's been sort of a character lurking on the side. And Gwen, throughout the books, has been trying to basically earn her way back to a change in her status, which is something she has to apply to the Court of Lunacy for. But one of the things that doesn't help is the fact that she's also getting involved in solving murder mysteries, which is not something a sane person would really do. So that's always been a contradictory impulse with her.
Well, but she also has gone into business, you know, in the right sort marriage bureau, which doesn't sit terribly well. There's still a big prejudice among the British upper class about people engaged in trade. And, you know,
About among people engaged in trade, and also just in general about women engaged in any kind of business. So that was, the real business did exist was very unusual, and they had a great deal of trouble getting financing, you know, from banks and things like that, as my characters have as well. So I've been playing with all the societal prejudices against every aspect of their lives and what they have to do. And, you know, in some ways, both of them are overqualified for doing what they're doing, but they really are not necessarily able to do anything else at this point.
Absolutely. So Iris Sparks, the other member of this team, the one with the British intelligence background, mm-hmm. she doesn't really fit into post-war society comfortably, and she doesn't really like attachment. She's not a fan of great attachment. So she has a boyfriend who's a gangster, I guess we could say, or certainly one of the civs, as they call them. And, you know, that creates a whole different set of issues and problems for her. And it also probably complicates the life of her partner, if anybody really paid attention to Iris's way of life, for the more respectable widow trying to claim her own.
Yeah, it's a complication, but it's also a resource, definitely, for what they, you know, as they get involved in. The thing about my amateur detectives, they don't want to be detectives. They don't want to get involved in any of the investigations that right. they have been involved in, but they're always sort of drawn into them or forced into them by circumstances. And Iris's connections both with British intelligence, which she's no longer part of, but still knows people in, and then also their connections to the underworld through this gangster and through the black market are all resources that they can draw upon when needed, including occasionally hiring them as muscle, you know, when they don't want to. You know, Iris is the muscle, but, you know, if they need extra hands on deck, they can usually resort to Archie and his gang. So that's been all part of it.
Well, they're straddling layers of society. And it's intriguing how their business, a marriage bureau, kind of draws them into things. And in this one, you can already tell from the title, The Lady from Burma, because Burma is not the name of Myanmar anymore, although I still think of it as Burma, was going to be close to the end of the war before Burmese independence and so forth. If you watch the new Jack Ryan, the apparently last one with the current cast, there's a whole segment that takes place in Myanmar now, you know, the new name for Burma, and involves, you know, a kind of cartel or gang in Myanmar and shots of the countryside. And at one point, there's a very dramatic shot of what was basically a British, I can't remember if it was a British administrative headquarters or a prison camp or something, but anyway, one of the Burmese, i.e. Myanmar people, was still pissed off about it, you know, and it's kind of the thrust of the anger driving that character was, in fact, the British colonial you know, rule over Burma or Myanmar. But in any case, and this, I love the fact the lady from Burma seems exotic. And she's a character that brings a very unusual request to the Marriage Bureau. And then the events afterward push Iris and Gwen into another investigation. So why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So normally people come to the Marriage Bureau seeking to become married. You know, there are single people who, for whatever reason, don't find that they can find the appropriate spouse, you know, through whatever circles they are in. And everything's been in upheaval since the war. But in this particular case, the woman who comes in is, in fact, already married. This is Mrs. Remagen. And what it turns out is that she has come to find a wife for her husband because she knows that she's dying from cancer. And her husband, who she had married in Burma when she had grown up there, was a professor of entomology. He is obsessed with insects, but he's not so good with people. And she was worried that since they're now displaced and in London, and he's also been through the war, that when she goes, he's not going to have what is needed to find someone else in his life. And he's someone who's still in his 40s. So she has taken it upon herself to engage the Right Sort Marriage Bureau to, after a suitable period after she passes away, to begin looking for somebody to take care of him, to become his new wife. And that's how things start.
You know, a Marriage Bureau has basically been replaced by all the internet dating sites or hookup sites or Tinder or, you know, whatever it is that go on there. And so, you know, it's certainly not an unusual or, you know, a dated issue about how people who would like to have some sort of partner go about finding them. It's just that we've found a different way to go about it than the Marriage Bureau. But so Iris and Gwen try to do that kind of matchup thing, you know, get a profile of their client and try to match two clients with each other with varying degrees of success. But they can't really do that with this woman because she's married and dying, and they don't know her husband. I mean, he's not part of this current picture. Also, the dying woman, isn't she the one with the money?
There are things that we find out about her as the mystery develops, but she is wealthy. And she's able to afford to engage their services. And, you know, there are a lot of things we find out during the course of events about her background. She ends up dying fairly early. And initially it looks like it's a suicide, but this being a murder mystery, of course, it's not. But the police generally, with the exception of one constable, believe that it's just a suicide and don't have any interest in pursuing it. But the constable who finds her, who begins investigating her, also finds in her purse a flyer for the Right Sort Marriage Bureau, which brings him coming back to Gwen and Iris, and that's how they get involved.
Right, and Gwen and Iris don't believe in suicide at all because, you know, they've already talked to her and figured out this plan, The suicide would not make any sense in the context of it all. I really like the woman who dies. You know, so I think in the best murder mysteries, she really mourned the victim. And even though she was already under a death sentence, she was somebody that, you know, you wished would stick around.
I've always heard, you know, there are people say, well, you want to have the death in the first chapter. You want to, you know, have something right away because that, you know, boom, we're on it and everything's happening. But I've always been a person who wants you to know who the person is before that happens. So it'll for me, that raises the interest in them and, you know, makes you care more for what's going on rather than just somebody who stumbles across a body and then, oh, let's find out about it. You know, so I like the reader to get to know the character.
I agree with you. I think it is important that the reader mourn the victim on, you know, regret their death. And the person who said that to me years ago went on to say that, you know, it also adds dimension if you empathize with the villain, although I find that to be harder to do. And in your book, this is a pretty cold villain, so we're not going to be able to discuss why I say that, but nonetheless, I'm not empathetic with the villain, but I am sad that the widow, the about to be deceased woman, dies, and her husband, I don't think anybody really ever suspects him because he is so sort of classically, one of those absent-minded sort of, British dons, whatever you want to call it, professor. Mm-hmm. But even though he's the guy that's going to inherit a lot of money and so forth, he's not really an obvious suspect, is he?
I don't think he's obvious. I don't think he's not a suspect, though,
Oh, okay.
The thing about any mystery book is that there's a limited number of people. So one of them, whoever's left, somebody's got to be in there who's the murderer, so everybody else gets to be a suspect, I guess. So I don't want to rule anybody out right away.
Okay, that makes sense. Sometimes we've been watching a lot of, during COVID, and still continue watching a lot of crime drama on TV, especially foreign ones, which I really love. And at some point, if you're really paying attention, you recognize that the superfluous person in the cast, the one who doesn't really need to be sticking around, or the bigger name actor that somehow is taking what looks like a secondary role, is almost surely going to turn out to be the bad guy. But in books, that isn't quite so obvious that, you don't have
good luck.
Don't have those issues. So, that one strand of the book is this woman comes and sets up a contract for her husband with the marriage bureau, hoping that he will find a companion when she's gone. But the other, there's a smaller track about Iris and where she's going to go with the boyfriend she has, or how that's going to work. But really, don't you think a huge amount of the real estate in this book is devoted to Gwen and the lunacy court? How that's going to go on. I mean, that plot strand, which has been there from the very first book, really needed resolving. And this is the fifth book in the series. So, seemed like a good time to bring it to an end. So she has, she's had to petition to get herself out of the lunacy court and become a whole person again.
Yes, a change in status. She's the technical term was she was a ward of the crown, because everybody who was in lunacy court, lunacy was a branch of chancery,
right?
And chancery belonged to the crown. So everybody who is a lunatic is considered to be a ward of the crown. And there was a whole series of procedures, and during the course of the books, she's basically got to sort of claw her way back to it legally and psychiatrically. So we know that she has a psychiatrist, and in the fourth book, she finally obtains a barrister who's going to represent her, and that's in The Unkempt Woman. One of my favorite chapters is her meeting the barrister and explaining, yes, I got involved in all these murder investigations, but I'm not crazy, and so he's finally in the timeline. I have to wait for the courts to actually start up again, because they were still in their summer sessions. So in October, they start up again, the Michaelmas term. And so she finally has to bring her petition forward. And I've been sort of waiting for this. And in the question is whether, everybody's going to approve it. There are all family members could come into it. There's her guardian or committee can come into it. It could be just a simple process of filing the papers and the judge saying, fine with me, boom, you're now restored, or things can go horribly wrong. Me being a mystery writer, things, of course, go horribly wrong. But the question is why, and what is she going to do about it? And what can the lawyer do about it? And I actually was, doing a lot of research on, what I could find of the procedures for that court at that time. My one regret is I couldn't find an actual transcript of some proceedings. I don't know, I probably would have had to travel there and then begged or something like that to see it. I'm sure a lot of that's just sealed. So us mystery authors just can't go poking into people's actual lives as much as we want to. But I was able to find a lot of procedural stuff that I could use, and some of that makes its way into the book.
Right. Well, Gwen, you know, Gwen can't do all this by herself. It requires a considerable backup from other people if she's going to win through. And I think, was it in book three that her in-law, because her father-in-law was so hostile to her at the outset, and her mother-in-law too, but she's kind of gradually worked her way through much of the family problem. Wasn't it in book three where her father-in-law has the crisis, the financial and health crisis, or was it book four?
Yeah, that was in book three. And that was also one where, because of the crises, and you know, both in terms of what he was trying to do and what he failed to do and what she was able to do, is that she's beginning to assert herself more within the family, to the point where, you know, if they're not necessarily allies, they're not necessarily enemies, you know. So it's been a gradual process, you know, first with her mother-in-law, then with her father-in-law, and that's been going on throughout, you know. So there's still, both of those people are still characters who pop up for different reasons. And since it's all tied in with, among other things, the family corporation, her father-in-law is still very much a player in her life.
And absolutely. Everybody on the board. Pardon me, I have a dog here who suddenly appeared. What is it you want? Huh? I can't pick you up. Remember that? Do you want to say hi? No?
I would love to see the dog, yes.
Yes, Harry wants to see the dog. Let me see if I can show him to you, because he's actually fabulous. But I'm not supposed to lift anything. There he is. There he is. Now, I've had surgery on my hand, and I'm not supposed to be doing that. Say hi, Scoot. Are you going to say hello?
Hello, Scoot.
Hi. He just got groomed, and he smells so good. He's like a big powder puff. But anyway, so pardon me. Let me move that back up. So so Gwen has actually been forced, for various reasons, to live in roughly the same domicile as her in-laws, partly because her son is there and kind of in the custody of her in-laws while she is awarded the court. The little boy is not a ward, is he?
No, but he's in the custody, legal custody of his grandparents now, because her in-laws, when she was committed to the sanatorium, she lost custody of her child. And you know, they were the relatives on the scene. So, and also people of wealth and influence. So they were able to gain custody of him. So he's been little Ronald Jr. Has been a recurring character, of course. And I've been enjoying his scenes. I'm trying not to make him a precocious, obnoxious child, you know, like you find in some things, but I like him. And he's been become obsessed with drawing narwhals because he saw one in the British Museum, which are the, you know, the mammals with the tusks for their noses. So he has been drawing his adventures, the adventures of his imaginary narwhal friend, Sir Oswald the Narwhal. One of the things I have loved about when the Japanese versions came out, whoever is the cover artist has worked a narwhal into each of the covers. Little small thing there. So she's just, so I've communicated with her, just expressed my delight in this. We've decided that narwhals are our spirit animals.
I love it. And narwhals are, many people think, kind of the inspiration for unicorns, aren't they? Because
probably,
they have that single horn that comes out of their heads. So anyway, there's a lot going on with Gwen, more so in this book. She gets more real estate than Iris, just because this whole lunacy thing has been part of the story from the very beginning. The family business, if I recall, Alan, is isn't it in Africa or something? I mean, it's part of that whole British colonial thing, right?
So yeah,
It's not like down there in the city of London.
Right.
Business. And so the war and the, you know, the beginning of the end of the British Empire is also having a real effect on the family business.
It probably, that's looming. And, you know, it's a combination of things. They have minings, particularly copper holdings in East Africa, but they've also developed munitions factories in England. So they have, you know, they have their own supply chain going from Africa. And of course, you know, probably made a fortune supplying the British Army during the war with munitions and such. So Gwen is going to be, you know, Gwen has inherited 40% of that through her husband, her late husband. But her father-in-law also has 40%. And then there's the rest of the board who divvy up the remaining 20. So, you know, so that's plays a part in a couple of the books. And this is one where, although she hasn't, you know, actually taken control of her fortune yet, because the committee is still acting as her presence on the board for her. She is invited to a board meeting for the first time by the acting CEO because her father-in-law is still recovering from his physical ailments. So I have a board meeting in there, and that sounds like, oh boy, that's going to be really boring. But it's where a lot of action happens as well. And I did find transcripts of board meetings, and I don't wish that on anyone yet, but I did read some.
Well, once the lunacy thing is settled, if it is settled, then there's plenty mm-hmm. of controversy ahead when it comes to, you know, how's the company going to go? If Gwen and her father-in-law are equally balanced, then actually the people with the 20% are in play, should they disagree. And then, you know, it's going to be a question of winning them over on one side or the other. And also, so Gwen can have an interesting life without the marriage bureau if, you know, if she's freed up. But Iris is another question. So should Gwen decide to spend more energy on her corporate life, what do you envision for Iris?
That's part of the tension going on between them right now, because, you know, when they started the bureau, it was for Gwen, it was something to keep her occupied. She had met Iris by chance at a wedding where both of them had something to do with fixing up the bride and the groom together, but from different sides of it. And they find that between them, they have a knack for this. So, you know, for Iris, this is her profession now, but for Gwen, she doesn't need the money. This is something that she enjoys doing. And also, you know, has become great friends with Iris. So the, you know, the friendship is important, but there is the tension because they are from different economic classes and they have different needs going on in terms of the finances of the bureau. And Gwen could basically, if she comes into a fortune, subsidize the entire thing, but that would also, you know, to Iris's mind, undercut what they're trying to do. You know, it's more important that they try and make it independently. So there's a tension that does crop up between them from time to time. But on the other hand, there's another tension from the fact that Iris has had much more of an education and knows more about the world than Gwen does, because Gwen has been pretty much confined to the aristocracy and doing all the things that you're supposed to do when you're a female in the aristocracy. So she's been to boarding school in Switzerland, but that's it.
Well, it's certainly true that Iris could run the marriage bureau on her own better than Gwen could ever have done it.
Well, and not in terms of the matching, though. They both bring something to the table. You know, it takes, you know, the two of them, you know, see people differently. And so they do complement each other in that sense, both in terms of the matching and also in terms of these murder investigations, which keep cropping up. So each has something they can come up with.
So the second book in this series, given the fact that we've had not one, but two deaths in the British royal family, which have really changed things. The second book is called A Royal Affair. And fascinatingly, it focuses in part on Prince Philip's mother.
Yes.
And he's trying to remember, were they engaged in 1947, he and Elizabeth?
They actually got engaged in the end of 46.
They're heading towards marriage, right?
The 47 was the marriage. Yeah, I think it was in October, maybe. But I think the engagement was announced in something like September, October. All the papers were abuzz when he went off to Balmoral to spend time with the family, because they thought, oh, is that going to happen? You know, they'd already been seen together at different, you know, other weddings and at ceremonial occasions. Yeah. So the rumors were running rampant at the time.
As I understand it, she took one look at him and that was it, when she was like 14 or something.
13. Yeah, 13. Yeah. She I think he was still a naval cadet. And there's a moment where she had seen him on a bunch of other cadets when they were doing something ceremonial where the British royal family was then going to take off on a launch or something. And he sort of paddled after the boat waving and you know, she fell in love with him and kept his picture on her bureau for her teens until, you know, he finally
He was an extraordinarily handsome man. And, you know, I can easily understand how that would have worked out. Her choices were probably more restricted post-war than they might have been before.
Oh, quite a bit.
World War II. There might have been a lot more pressure on her to marry differently, but he was, after all, you know, from the Greek royal family. So
there were also cousins on both sides. Yeah.
Yep. But what's interesting, I think, is the plot of, which we can't talk about, of the second book involving Philip's parents and whether, in fact, he was really going to be a suitable husband for the future queen. I love that. And there were many things in it that I never knew. You must have had a lot of fun researching that book.
Oh, a tremendous amount. And the research for me is really one of the great parts of writing historical mysteries, you know, just because I get to dive in and you never know what's going to trigger, you know, it could be a paragraph, could be a whole plot line, you know, little things will crop up and, you know, things I didn't know. So like the whole thing about, you know, when I wrote the first book, I knew that Gwen was going to be someone who had been in a sanatorium. But I hadn't done the full investigation over what the legal procedures were as of the first book, but it was around that time, you know, going into the second book, where I learned about the Court of Lunacy. And the moment I heard it was actually called that, I went, yes, thank you. You know, I can run with that. So you never know what the research is going to turn up, whether it's going to be a little throwaway thing or whether it's going to be a full plot line.
Absolutely true. I think it's been a fascinating series. Do you have other series ideas? I mean, was there a long gap between Fest the Fool, which is what, 13th century? And
yeah, well, in between, so the last Fool's Guild book, I wrote 8 of those. That was in 2010. Okay. And I started writing this series 2017. The first one came out in 2019. Because it takes me about a year to write it, and then it takes them about a year after that to put it out. In between that, I wrote a werewolf book, which I loved.
You wrote a what?
A werewolf book, which is out there, a very small press. I got recruited for a Christmas werewolf anthology by Charlene Harris and Tony Kellner out of the blue, which is, I would never have thought of writing either things, but Tony came buttonholed me and said, have you thought about werewolves? I didn't know, but those are fun. And then I've been writing, I got into writing musical theater, during that period as well. So that's been something else. That's like the third thing I'm doing in my life. So that's, you know, not one that's particularly lucrative, but it's a blast. And every now and then something will actually get, you know, performed, either a stage reading at a full production at a little theater in Michigan. It was one of the best times of my life, you know? So I'm doing that. And so that was in between those two things. And there was another book I wrote that was a very personal thing that I haven't gotten published yet. And I still think it might be the best thing I've ever written, but it might be too personal. So we'll see what happens with that.
You'll have to decide that. I mean, it seems to me you're a person who really loves to tell stories. So, you know, you're probably not going to run out of material. But do you think your focus is really always going to remain historical, aside from the personal book?
No, not necessarily. There's a book I'm planning to write next year, I think. My sort of life goal is I want to retire from the day job next year, you know, after work. I'm going to be hitting a certain age where that will be a little more viable. And so I want to keep this series going, but I also want to write. There's another book I had an idea for, which my agent thinks is a good one. And that's going to take research. It's going to be a combination of contemporary thriller and with some historical background. And I don't quite know what it is yet because I haven't done the research yet. Right. But that's, you know, I've got the idea, you know, and that's all I need to start.
It sounds like, you know, lots of good things coming for you. The other thing that's good news is there are lots of avenues to publishing that have opened up. COVID revealed even more, but as major publishing has consolidated more and more, it's opened up a kind of like mushrooms, you know, opportunities for people to find other ways to get their books to fans. And if you're a published author and you already have a fan base, that's a lot easier than if you're a brand new author. I think that would be very, very tough for somebody just starting out with no particular fan base. But you know, for somebody like you, Alan, who's got, you know, two wonderful series and other stuff, you know, you have a lot of freedom, I think, going forward to tell your stories in different ways.
Yeah, it's for me, you know, the fact that I've had the day job, it sort of takes the pressure off of I have to sell. Right. You know, I mean, I want to, but, you know, it's for me, it's I write because I love to write. You know, I would be writing if nobody bought a single book. You know, I mean, I would like them to buy more than a single book. Right. But, you know, it's something I want to do. It's something I need to do, you know, and it's something, you know, it's the sort of thing where I can sort of shut out the world and create my own. And I'm happy there for, you know, small portions of time. It's like the one area of my life I have a little bit of control over sometimes, you know, so that's part of the fun.
I love the humor in your books. They're always, you know, I mean, part of it is just the voices that you create, but part of it is the situations. You like to juxtapose some, I don't even know what the word I want is here. I was going to say eccentric, but I don't think that's true. Unusual, anyway.
Yeah.
And that there's layers in the books, if you're paying attention when you read them, that are a lot of fun to explore. So whatever you do, I'm sure I'm going to absolutely love reading it. How did you develop your writing style? I mean, you know, we've never met in person, at least.
Yeah, we did once. I was out at the store one time in the first series.
Oh, that's long, right. Ago. Long ago with Fest. All right. But it was so long ago, I obviously can't remember. But, you know, do you find in your, you know, everyday life that you are what's the word I want? Quietly subversive?
Oh, I'm noisily subversive sometimes. Humor for me has always been a... oh boy, this is getting into deep psychology. You know, it was something that was for me a defense mechanism. I'm sure for as a lot of humor is for people, but it's also part of my personality. I think that I had, you know, early influence growing up were the Marx Brothers, but I was also very much into jazz because my father was a jazz composer and musician. And I wanted to, you know, be a jazz player at one point. So the two of them have in common improvisation. And so improvisation is something that I do just sort of on a daily basis, you know, and it's something that is useful for the day job, you know, because I can take things and run with them depending on what's going on. And, you know, the idea of being able to make people laugh is something that I enjoy. And it's something that's, you know, it can deflect tension. It can deflect anger. It can do a lot of things, you know, and they're in the right times. You know, it's not something I want to do all the time because that'd be truly obnoxious. But it's been part of it. Yeah.
Well, right. Well, one of the reasons I love reading Alan's books is they are always deliciously different. And, you know, sometimes there can be a lot of sameness if you read, as I have to do, if you have to read a lot of books in a row. Sometimes even the voices kind of blur, but with Alan, they're always distinctive. They're always just Alan. And I really like the offbeat nature of what intrigues him. So again, British mystery, and Lewis Fest the Fool, also British mystery, or at least continental. I'm trying to remember, was this British or was he? Yeah, it was French, wasn't he?
Well, if you keep reading the series, you discover the fact that he was born in Denmark. That's his origin story. Yeah. But he's multilingual, so he gets all over the place.
He's a wonderful character. Have you ever thought about bringing him back?
I would have kept going with him, but, you know, it wasn't my call. Unfortunately, I might, you know, get around to doing a short story or something with him again. And, you know, that would take, you know, I would have to take the time to reread the entire series and everything, all my research notebooks, and just get all of the information and the voices back in my head again. So, you know, that might be another thing for when the day job is done. We'll see. I'm not saying no. I'm just saying right now I'm doing this.
Well, it'd be wonderful if even, you know, you were able to bring back the old books with maybe new introductions or something of the sort. That would be
fine with that. Yeah.
There are loads of readers who've not read them. You know, so it would be historical mysteries making has made a big comeback. over the last, you know, their cycles in publishing. When I opened the store, all historical fiction was not doing well. And so historical fiction writers back in the end of the 80s and in the early 90s all decided to write mystery. Partly it was Ellis Peters and A Morbid Taste for Bones. Partly it was Umberto Eco and The Name of the Rose. But there was this whole kind of, and so all during the 90s, historical mystery was huge. And then, as often happens, everybody kind of turned in a different direction. And historical mystery, I mean, there was hardly a country in an era that you could not find a book. I mean, we, you know, we could be all over Egypt. There was Babylonia. You know, we had Greece. We had, you know, all different periods of British history. Rarely the 17th century. Very rare. It was just like everybody skipped. You know, we did medieval, we did Elizabethan, we could do Georgian, but somehow Jacobean never really attracted a lot of crime, you know, mystery writers. But anyway, you know, and now that cycle is coming back up again. So there's, I think, much more of an appetite right now for historical fiction. In part, I think when the world is truly falling apart, as it currently is, it's very comforting to read about earlier times when we all know how it came out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, writing about for them, you're reading about post-war London. And one of the reasons that, you know, people like to read about it is we already know how the war came out.
Yeah. But the next thing is starting already, you know. So one thing I want to get to, I gave Iris a Cambridge education, is I do want to look into the Cambridge spies at some point. So that'll be a fun one to get into.
Fascinating drama, you know, the difference between Oxford and Cambridge and what is it? What was it that got those guys, you know, was it really some kind of ideological commitment, or did they just want to, you know, prove that they were smarter than everybody, or did they love having secrets that nobody else knew, or what, you know, what drove them? I think they're a fascinating group, really do. So there's an awful lot you could still explore, and I'm sure to hear that you're thinking about it. So let's call Jacob up and see, Jacob, if we have any questions from the audience before I'm devoured by puppies who are now ringed around me, all going, it's dinner time, Mom, right?
Hello, Jacob.
Hey, Alan. You got some questions here on Facebook. Go ahead and read them out. Judy Singer asks, at the end of the last book, Iris says she is still in love with her first fiance. Mike, do you take that anywhere in this book or in future books? Are you planning?
Iris's love life continues to be complicated, and Mike will continue to recur as a character. More than that, I will not tell you.
Right. Janice Crombie Cross asks, what is your day job, by the way?
I'm a public defender. Been doing that for next month. September 10th will be my 39th anniversary at the Legal Aid Society in New York City. So criminal defense. You get arrested in New York and you can't afford anyone better than me, then you get me.
I don't think that's really quite the right way to phrase it, Alan, for heaven's sake.
You could do a lot worse than me, though.
Right.
I'm pretty good at this.
Why historical fiction would interest you rather than the current state of the criminal defense bar.
Because it's an escape for me too, you know.
You bet.
This one asks, when did you know that you wanted to be a writer? Did you know very early in life?
Probably when I was 8, I was writing stuff. My parents encouraged me to read everything, and I was a voracious reader. And they encouraged me to read without censorship, you know. So I kept reading. And I remember my mother saying to me when I was going to sixth grade, I think you're ready for Kafka, you know. And then I got into the writer who completely blew me away in my teens was Thomas Pynchon. So I wanted to write like, and also Tom Stoppard, the playwright. So, you know, I wanted to write like them. And you know, nobody can, you know, and I was foolish to try, but they encouraged me to try and improve what I needed to know to become a writer. And then a lot of it was just learning by doing. But you know, yeah, I would say basically from the age of 8 on, you know, I said, so I can write my own thing. I got I got encouragement from teachers and from my parents whenever I wrote anything. So that was always a good reinforcement.
So was going to law school just kind of a backup?
Law school was a pragmatic decision. When I was thinking about the future, I was thinking theater. Then I thought, no, starvation. And then I thought, go for a PhD in English Lit. But my dad is an academic. My aunt's an academic. I don't have any illusions about the academic world. You know, unless you're really going to get a top-notch job, it's really not as much fun as it sounds like. You know, it doesn't even sound like that much fun. So I thought, you know, law was something I could do well. And where law helped with the writing was it taught me precision, because I was trying to do all sorts of stoppery, pinch-y things with the language, and I just wasn't really good enough at it. So legal writing is about precision, you know, getting a word to say, you know, like as Humpty Dumpty say, when I choose a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean, neither more nor less, you know. And so that was helpful in terms of pulling me back. And then when I finally started writing, and I'm pretty much self-taught, mostly self-taught as a writer, I think there was a balance between those two things. I was able to allow myself to free up the writing, but then also know when to rein it in and not get too far away. So it's been a balance. Long-winded answer to that question, but that's that.
That's it. I think it's a really fascinating, everybody's path to writing is different. And I do think that readers enjoy, you know, knowing how it worked. It's not transferable, however. Sadly enough, oftentimes we find people ask about writing process, I think hoping to stumble on, you know, some sort of magical gateway into doing it.
What I tell people, they'll say, oh, I want to write a book. I said, write. You write every day. And, you know, it may not be any good, but it will train your brain to expect, you know, to condition your brain says, okay, this is the writing time. You know, it's good to have a specific time. And if you write 2 pages a day, and then at the end of the year, you have a really, really long book. May not be any good, or you got to cut it down. But the other thing you'll find is that if you look at what you wrote a year ago and look how you're writing now, you'll find that you've improved, you know, and that so you'll have developed hopefully some aesthetic and skill at it. So I think that's the best thing I can say, you know, and the other thing is read. And if you like something, think about why you liked it, what the author did, and if you don't like it, what the author did there, and you know, avoid those mistakes.
Very good advice. Jacob, anything else?
Do you have any favorite contemporary authors, particularly in the historical fiction genre?
Again, whenever Pynchon writes, I'm buying it hardcover the day it comes out. Colson Whitehead is fabulous. I just bought he's got a second book of a trilogy, and I'm finally reading the first book, but he's somebody who can write all sorts of different eras. My aunt, who is 92 and still reads Up a Storm, and this book is dedicated to her, put me onto Richard Powers a couple of years ago. So I read the Overstory, which is not historical so much, but he's written some stuff that's, I think, in historical, you know, so there are a lot of people in the historical mystery writers, you know, and I've gotten to know a lot of them, like Mariah Fredericks is great. I read the Lindbergh Nanny, which is up for awards. And she's also, doesn't live far from me. So we've gotten to be friends, you know, so it's been nice to meet her.
We did a very nice program with her when the Lindbergh Nanny came out. And I thought she did, a lot of work, a lot of research, you know.
Yes.
It's a controversial case on which to build, but I thought she did a very good job with the direction that she elected to take.
Yeah, I thought she did too.
There's one more question. I think you talked about your sense of humor a little bit. And this one asked if you wanted to talk a little bit about your fascination with the court fool or the jester. And I guess this is about your Fool's Guild.
Yeah. Series. That came out of Shakespeare and studying it in college, you know. And
do you have the jester often associated with death too, like Shakespeare?
Well, it can be, definitely, because he has, you know, the... you know, the jester's staff that some of them used, you know, frequently was a death figure. And there's some overlap between, you know, the fooling and, you know, death is the sort of ultimate leveler of all society, and so is the fool, you know. So there's always been some symbolic links between the two, and that was fun to play around with when I was writing that series. What happened was I took a Shakespeare course, which we read all of the plays. It was a seminar, and then you meet with the professor once a week for 5 hours in our living room. So it was intense and it was fun. And I used to shoot silly ideas with a friend of mine from the class. And one of the ones I came up with was that the jester in the different plays was the same guy, just kept moving from gig to gig to gig, ultimately dies under the name of Yorick. And then his scepter is passed on. Then his scepter is passed on down to Portia in The Merchant of Venice, if you really want to do a deep dive, you know. And that sort of stuck in my head, and of this idea of the jester being moving across the different Shakespearean landscape. And I originally thought of it sort of as a fantasy idea. And he had a villain who was also going to pursue him, who was Malvolio here, and he was, I don't know, whoever there. And I didn't like that idea of the fantasy, but years later, when I was trying to write mysteries, it just popped into my head again. And all of a sudden I saw the idea of Festi sitting at the end of a tavern and somebody coming up to him and says, Orsino's dead. And that's how 13th Night started. So
one of the things that I've always remembered about reading them was the sheer athleticism involved in being a successful fool.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You have to do athletics. You have to do
real gymnastic stuff going on there too.
Yeah. You know, for my fool. Sure. I have some fools across the course, of the series where we're, you know, less athletic than my guy, but my guy was athletic.
Your guy was, you know, he was fabulous lead character. I just was crazy about him and the whole cast, you know, it was great. Yeah. Wait, sure, the Shakespearean echoes in all of it, you know. I mean, how can you miss with 13th Night?
Yeah. You know,
kicking off from 12th Night is pretty hard to, you know, to go wrong there. But it's a wonderful series. I haven't looked for a long time. Is it mostly going to be available at the moment in used books? Or is there an electronic version of the books?
There's electronic versions of all of them except for the fourth and fifth books. And I don't know why they did it that way. It might have been something, because when they first started, my original series, I think, predated the online books, you know, so the contracts.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, right?
Yeah, the first one came out in 1999, I think. So the fourth and fifth books are The Widow of Jerusalem and An Antic Disposition. An Antic Disposition draws from the Hamlet story, or the precursors to the play, you know, the Icelandic sagas and such. And those to me are the two best books in the series in terms of, you know, I think in terms of the writing. And they're not available online. So, you know, I encourage people to find them because I think they're really good. But the rest of them are ebooks available. So starting with 13th Night.
Well, I really urge you to try them. And I also urge you to read all five of the Sparks and Bainbridge series, because they're really wonderful.
Thank you.
First two are available. Let me just run by the names again, because I'm terrible on names. The Right Sort of Man and A Royal Affair, available in paperback. And then we have A Rogue's Company. Is Rose Company also available?
We're back to, yeah, that is definitely
in paper. So then The Unkept Woman and now The Lady from Burma. So it's easy enough to acquire all five of them. And while the mystery is complete in each book, I think they read better if you read them in order, because the character arcs and the ongoing story, for example, we've talked about Gwen's ongoing story. I think it will mean more and sort of make more sense if you start it when it starts and then read your way along. And five books is not a big commitment. It's not like this is book 17 or something. So why not, right?
I think all of you can do it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all. Alan, always a treat to see you. I will look forward
to seeing what
we do next. Thank you all for joining us. Jacob, thank you for sitting in the sun. And it's probably not
funny. Thank you, Jacob.
Right. And our autographed copies of The Lady from Burma, which really does have an amazing plot, are in the store. And I urge you to while away these dog days of July with something that's a real treat. And speaking of dog days, I'm going to go feed mine before they devour me. So thank you, everybody. Good night.
Thank you. Be cool, everybody.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them and your help would be appreciated, please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.